Hey, everybody. I want to say thank you very much for following and checking out this show. The response has been way greater than I could have hoped for, so thank you. I know that between this podcast and my mini dive series I've been doing on our band YouTube channel that I've put out a lot of information in a short amount of time. So I want to offer up a chance for you to ask questions. Maybe you want to know a follow-up thing about a guest I interviewed or some detail I didn't spend a whole lot of time on in the mini dive, or just whatever. I will select video-based questions and put you along with my answer in a podcast episode airing the week of maybe September 21st. All you have to do is post a 15-second or less video of you asking me a question on your personal Twitter or Instagram, no stories, and tag @JimmyWorld #passthroughfrequencies. By submitting your video via the instructions outlined, you are authorizing pass-through frequencies to use and edit the submitted content for audio, video, or otherwise for a future episode of the podcast. Also, Fender, the guitar company you might have heard me mention on this show, is giving away one of my signature Telecasters, the JA90. For a chance to win, visit this easily remembered woodbox.com site that I'm putting in the episode notes. Submissions for questions and the giveaway will be closing Thursday, September 17th at 11:59 p.m. Pacific. Thanks a lot, and now on with the show. Today I'm talking to Courtney Marie Andrews. We were working on our album, Invented, and there were a few songs where I thought it'd be great to have a female vocalist who could go in between the really full-voiced, strong, higher-range things, but also like kind of more speaking voice, expressive singing. Courtney absolutely killed everything we put in front of her. It was just an obvious thing to ask her to tour with us. So Courtney came on the road with us playing keyboards and guitar and doing backup vocals for about a year and a half almost. Since then, Courtney hasn't really stopped. She's put out album after album. She's done tour after tour. She's supported artists all over the world. Courtney is an all-around total badass. My conversation with Courtney Marie Andrews happened on July 11th of 2020. Well, thanks for hanging out with me again.
Yeah. Sorry, there's been a couple hiccups.
Yeah, no, it's totally all good. And I'm sorry for the major hiccup on my part.
Oh, it's all good.
I talked to you first when I was like still thinking I knew what I was doing, but not really. And plus like May was like 16 years ago.
So, yeah, I know.
So
yeah,
there's that.
We've aged exponentially since then.
I know,
then.
I got like way more gray coming in here. It's not good, Courtney. It's not good.
I'm 30 this year, so I might be getting my first gray pretty soon.
Yeah, 30 is about when it starts happening.
Yeah.
When it gets real.
Yeah.
Actually, at about like 25, it starts getting real. Like you gotta start like watching what you eat. You can't like.
No, I know.
It's like things change. It's like, oh man, really?
That was about the year I started running.
Oh,
25.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's totally awesome. I think that, yeah, running, because I started in my 20s running. I think it was like 22, 21. I thought it'd be a good idea to start running. And then, honestly, I think like playing so many gigs has really helped my cardiovascular system.
Oh,
you know, like.
Oh, yeah.
Like yelling for an hour and a half every night for like, you know, half a year, basically.
Yeah, it's
for
great.
16 years. it kind of bought me some credit for when I started running. I wasn't so like totally gassed. You know, I could do like 10 miles. Not
and,
at first.
And you
but.
Know, loading the van
yeah.
always helps too.
taking a goddamn SVT bass cabinet upstairs.
Oh yeah,
to
that's
play,
always
or down into a basement somewhere.
God. Oh man, the European staircases.
Oh dude, I was just thinking that we played upstairs in some cafe in Lyon, France, and it was a spiral staircase straight up, So it's like the SVT base cabinet, like the refrigerator thing. We had to take it like vertically up the stairs, like until we got up there.
Wow. That sounds horrible.
It was horrible.
Honestly, though, I'd give anything right now to, load some gear.
I would gladly load an SVT cabinet upstairs, up direct stairs to be able to play.
Me too.
You would not hear me complain.
Yeah.
At all.
Exactly.
It is kind of crazy. So you're just putting out an album.
Yes.
A week from today. A week from today?
Yeah.
Oh, man. So you got to be pumped.
I am. It's been a nice sort of, you know, with all the press and everything, I'm like, how did I do this while I was touring? We are such workaholics.
Yeah, I know. I was just about to ask, what's launching an album right now? What's it like? I mean,
it's a lot of like recording your own sessions at home. I did a Tiny Desk and we had to like self-record, self-engineer. And it was like, kind of has its own set of challenges, you know? And then obviously doing a lot of the press on Zoom calls and in weird hours, because you're, you know, talking to people from around the world and stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been interesting. It feels kind of sad to not be able to, tour it. But it's luckily, you know, a very personal record. So hopefully it's a good kind of at-home headphone record.
You know, it's not going to be forever. You'll get a chance for sure.
Oh, yeah. And it'll happen.
I mean, it's a time where you can be creative about how you present something, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You sort of don't have a choice but to get creative on how you present something.
Yeah, it's actually been so inspiring to see how people have gone creative with it, you know, because we are sort of, it's like a whole new set of obstacles. The music industry has had to like completely transform overnight. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, I mean, I don't know what it's going to look like after this, because I think there's going to be some things at work, and people are going to get used to those things. And then that's going to be kind of part of the way it is.
Yeah.
People kind of haven't figured out the home streaming thing just yet, or like the live stream thing just yet. There's like the stumbling blocks of engagement, like the two-way street. Like I can send something out and have it look cool and sound good, but do you feel like you're there? You know, like how does that happen?
Basically, I'm filming a live concert of my record top to bottom with just two other musicians and a cinematographer in a space, that's this beautiful space called the Parthenon in Nashville. And, you know, I feel like that's kind of, you do need those other elements, I feel like, to make it special. Like, you do need the people that are good at the sound and the cinematography and stuff. We've sort of been, like, forced to be good at all of it, and I don't think we're musicians, you know, at the end of the day, so... No, I haven't figured out my home setup in a way. I mean, it's as good as I can make it, but, you know, I'm a musician.
Yeah.
I'm not a cinematographer. Or
in normal times, you sort of need to have a working knowledge of a lot of different things as it is if you're going to have this be a sustainable business. And now I think it's like, it is a little bit daunting feeling like you have to add more hats to that skill set.
Yeah.
I guess. And video is one of them.
Yeah.
Social media influencer is another one.
Yeah.
I guess. Just like writing a song is like people obviously get turned off if they sense that you're chasing them. You know, because people can, I feel people can see that when you're just, pay attention to me, please, kind of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Desperate.
I feel like it's, like you said, it's very daunting to try and wear all the hats. I think, you know, we could do as best as we can. And I feel like as far as the music industry is concerned, like, I think what I'm most sad about is just, you know, some of the venues that won't be there when we come back. And I think it's certainly going to be more of I kind of feel like it's going to be more of like a DIY experience in the beginning.
It might be. Yeah, because you're not going to come out of the gates trying to like bump up in rooms with giant production. You know,
no,
like you're not.
No one
if anything,
is. Like,
no one yeah, is. You're gonna like do something you know you can execute, and that is probably gonna be like whatever small clubs are around.
Mm-hmm.
Or
yeah.
Or parks.
Yeah.
You know, it's theater, like you know, theater in the park kind of vibe, community theater sort of vibe. But
the drive-in?
Yeah, the drive. Oh God.
Have you seen some of those drive-in shows?
I've seen pictures of them.
Like from afar, yeah.
No, I haven't attended any. On one hand, all of this is really resetting your expectations because you mm-hmm. can't have the thing you really want.
Yeah.
You know? So like here's what you mm-hmm. can do. Here are your options. Like, you know, like a Ryman with every 10th seat sold. And people handed like face masks and face shields.
Yeah.
You want to play for that? I mean, if it's that or it's nothing, after a while, people are going to want to pay for that.
I think so too. I mean, people need to be around people. We have, you know, built a culture around being out. Like, I feel like I've read so many, you know, statements about people sort of just saying that my house was basically a vessel to sleep in, you know. This is like the longest I've spent at my house, not me personally, but like, well,
yeah,
me personally too, but you know, a lot of people, like, you know, I've just used their houses somewhere to sleep. And
that was our big strategy in the beginning of the band. It's like, why do we want to move to LA to pay a whole lot of money to have our stuff live in a room that we're not?
Yeah, that's what we are. We don't really need a place for anything else.
Definitely starting to get to me a little bit, I gotta be honest. You know, like I started off really amped up and like, all right, cool, everything's canceled. What can I do? I'm gonna do something else. Like when I get pumped up and motivated on something, like I'll go all in, I'll be stoked on it, I'll get like 4 or 5 days in, and then that starts wearing off. Or it starts getting hard. Like, I get the easy stuff out of the way, and then it starts getting hard. And then it stays hard, and I kind of plateau. And then I hit negative returns, and at some point I think, I got to shift gears. So I'm in a shifting gears mode now, I think.
Oh, man, you are not alone. I've actually had this conversation a few times. I think a lot of us were, you know, we're so used to change in the music industry. I feel like we're all so malleable, and like, we sort of thrive off change. And I think in the beginning, I think a lot of us were like, we got this, like, we're all in this together. We're going to like persevere. And then, you know, it's ending on month 5 of being locked down and quarantined and nobody knows the end. And I think it's starting to like the reality of the situation starting to sink in a little bit more. So I think that that's like a universal feeling for sure.
Yeah. You think you have a good grasp on the reality.
Yeah.
But after 5 months of the reality, it gets even more real.
Yeah.
But exactly. I'm still pretty positive about it though. It's just that I think I've let go of some of the expectations I had. Like now I'm thinking and I'm thinking like instead of going for like the creative thing, I'm gonna go for the get better thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm gonna take what I can do and maybe what I've put off doing for a while, and I'm going to try to get better at that. Maybe
that's great.
Maybe through that, it'll be an inspiring process. Because usually that's how it works. If I forget about trying to create, if I can, basically as soon as that is completely out of my mind, then things just start to happen. If I can just go into woodshedding mode and forget about writing is going to happen. I gotta say that quietly because I can't let myself hear that. Otherwise it won't work.
Jim, that's kind of my whole method. I try and not force it especially with this last record I'm about to release next week, I just didn't, I really didn't want to sit down and force myself to write a song. But it, you know, I'm sure you've had this as a songwriter, but this feeling where you know there's something like sort of rumbling below the surface and you just like, that's when you go for it, you know?
Like, I need the momentum a little bit without any expectation to let what's going to happen happen. And then from that, I kind of read the bones in that. And it tells me what I'm really want to do. And then I have something to push.
That's great. Sort of listening to the underlying muse.
Yeah, kind of like just like free writing with you know, set a timer and just free write with nothing. If it's nonsense, it's nonsense. If it's cool, it's not about the judgment. It's about just writing. And then when that's over, you kind of look through it and say, oh, that's really messed up. I could turn that into something. You're like, oh, what's this mean?
I think judgment's the hardest part of writing. I certainly, anytime I am going through a sort of slump in my writing process, it's generally because I'm being too judgmental of myself. Or not swerving, not doing something outside of my comfort zone.
So that's kind of the same thing like you were saying before about working from a place of strong inspiration.
I can tell internally when I'm trying to force a feeling or a song out. But obviously, that doesn't mean that people shouldn't, or I shouldn't, like, you know, put the head down and, like, put my pen to paper and really get to work. I think that's really important. And like you said, you have to execute actually working on it to make it possible. but I just have this note, like, I sort of internally know when I am ready to write a song, I guess. And that's sort of when I go with the inspiration.
I think I will push myself even if I'm not ready, because I feel like I should be ready.
I've done that before, for sure.
And I don't know if that gets me anywhere. There's definitely been times where I feel like I should be ready, because I just need one minor part to make it, to have it be what I consider complete.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that's like the hardest part. Like, you know, verse 2.
Yeah.
Like, why can't I write? I should be able to do that, right? Like, if I have my chorus and I know enough about what I've done, divining something from nothing, and I understand what it is. I have a chorus. I have even like a verse or even a bridge, and I need like verse parts.
Yeah. That's the hardest part.
Is there a section of the song lyrically that seems like the trickiest for you?
That's really funny you say that. My least favorite thing in songwriting that happens is when I write this amazing verse and then don't have a chorus idea. And generally, I do work backwards from choruses because of that. It's even better when it sort of comes out all in one lump, but I can't stand it when I know that a verse needs a chorus and I just can't sum it up. I'm like almost the opposite of you. Like, I love detailed, like almost every song could be a ballad if I wanted it to be, with just no choruses, just like verses after verses. But I try now to sort of work backwards from a phrase, which I know would be the chorus.
Have you ever tried writing like prose, like short story kind of thing? Because you definitely seem like you do like the details and the, you know, the what traditionally kind of goes into a verse, like the storytelling part of it.
It's really funny you say that, because since the last time we talked, I just got a publishing deal for...
Oh, no way!
Yeah.
Oh, that's so rad. Congratulations.
I know. Thank you. I'm so excited, and it's so crazy that it happened during this crazy year. It felt like a weird thing to celebrate, but it's so exciting. I'm going to be releasing my first collection of poetry next year. And so I have been, I write a lot of that. Yeah.
Oh, that's style. So great.
listening to songs, I've always been a words person. I hear words first. Words and melody, you know, it's kind of, I've had to train my brain to like not just think about that, you know.
But you're like a shredder guitar player too, though.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know why, but it never, I mean, obviously I've worked really hard at that, but it feels like words come more naturally to me, but maybe that's, I'm being hard on myself, but I don't know. Yeah, I just am really drawn to language, so.
So do you have like a lot of, so you'd be like, will you be writing all the time? Like what, with, even if it's not for a song, will you be thinking in verse-like construct, like poetry kind of forms, and just be like, kind of building stuff there?
Yeah, last year was really confusing because I actually started this book last year, at the top of the year, but I was simultaneously writing for Old Flowers, my upcoming record that's coming out next week, and it was strange, the battle between what I thought was a song and what I thought was a poem. So yeah, I am always writing, usually just have an intuitive feeling about which is which, but the quarantine, you know, especially since I got the deal, I've just been like purely focused on that because, you know,
because your record's in the can.
Yeah.
And what else are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it makes it less like confusing to go between both.
That's so awesome. That's really cool. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm so excited.
That's great. I used to like journal so often, so much, especially touring. I'd be, you know, before phones, I would journal. That'd be what I do. And, you know,
that's so healthy. That's great.
I know, right? I should just like throw, if I didn't, sometimes I want to just throw my phone away, but
I know,
but I can't. But yeah. And I would mine that for a lot of song material. And I wonder, are you doing the same thing with like writing without a song even in mind? Probably yields a lot of material for songs.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could just say, okay, I'm not writing for a song. I'm not writing for a song. I'm not writing for a song. It looks like it could be a song, but I'm not writing for a song.
Yeah, it's a strange feeling. I feel like the difference is that my songs are very conversational and my poems are, I kind of like feel like I take I attempt to take sort of the wise man philosophical route, and those feel different to me. It's very slight, but I don't know.
So they do. So your poetry could be mine for like chorus material.
Yeah.
If a poem just isn't feeling right, you could cannibalize it for a chorus.
A song.
Yeah. The bridge is like the most direct part for me of what I want to say with the song. It's like the no messing around, like kind of what a less elegant way of what the chorus is trying to say.
Yeah.
Like a more direct kind of thing. And then the chorus is kind of like it could be a more general thing. It can get wider, more vague. And then the verse is kind of like the more descriptive like foundation for where the chorus makes sense, kind of. It sort of like sets the scene for what the chorus is going to do.
It's funny that you say that about the bridge, because for me, the bridge can go either way. It's either like, how mysterious can I be in this section, or like you were saying, just how vague can I be? How can I say it clear? I have not made my point clear enough. That was my time.
Let me sit you down again and tell you about this thing I've been singing.
Exactly.
Now, I could see that going like off. I mean, because the point of it is to kind of get away, to sort of provide a new hook that would give a reason to come back to something that's familiar, like another chorus or another verse in a chorus. So going like topically, going vague or going sideways a little bit, I could see how that would definitely serve for the purpose of that section.
You know who I've been very sort of interested in, and always have been, but really just like purely because of form, is Bill Withers, because his form is so out there. Like, it's rarely, you know, a verse chorus bridge situation, and which is traditionally what, you know, I have always been drawn to and sort of write towards. But Bill just has like sections, you know, it's just like, right. That's made it very songwriting really exciting to me recently, just because it's like, well, I mean, if this doesn't need a verse, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's just like a chorus, bridge, C section, D section, you know, like,
yeah.
But somehow he makes those, you know, section type songs like pop songs.
Yeah, the trick to that,
amazing.
The trick to that is making each section feel like it's catchy enough. It has enough hooks on its own to be kind of self-sustaining.
A lot of new pop songs kind of have that too, where it's like 40 million sections.
there's only been a few times where that kind of has made sense to me for what the song sort of needed. And it was usually after trying to make it come back and realizing that, what do we gain by this? You know?
Yeah.
We did this, it goes to this place. And what do we really gain by having it come back? Let's just keep it going.
Yeah.
But I've never set out to say, okay, this is never coming back from the top. Like, this is the prompt for this idea. It's like, it's not coming back at all to anything.
I'm with you there. I've like primarily been influenced by the traditional song form and,
right.
Or at least the traditional pop song form.
Personally, I don't think your stuff has ever seemed like formulaic. It definitely has those elements to it, but it doesn't ever feel like all right, yeah, I saw that coming. Like, yeah, we know, we know.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess when you know your own tricks, it's hard to like.
Yeah.
To see what it is from the outside, you know.
Have you ever done that? Have you ever set like a prompt for yourself about the way a song is going to be before you even know what it's going to be about? Like saying that for yourself. Okay, this is I'm going to do something where it doesn't come back at all. Nothing repeats.
I have actually, because of I've been doing a lot of with my songwriting publisher, I've been doing getting a lot of prompts for ads and like that sort of thing, and it's sort of acted as this subliminary method where I do kind of force myself to do things like that, whether it be writing about a certain subject or not even knowing the subject, and they're just like, we need something that feels this way.
So that's the kind of that's the kind of stuff. I mean, you could always give yourself that as a prompt, I suppose. But having a real world deadline of like somebody else expecting you to come up with something that's like, you know, for whatever parameter that is.
You want to prove it to them. You want to like, yeah, when they send you a prompt, you're like, I got this. You know,
I'm a real songwriter. I can do it.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, it feels like, yeah, you're putting on your work pants.
I think about that, like in the day when people would, your writers would be in-house, like at a label. And that's what they would do. They'd go to work and they would just write songs. And then, you know, the A&R person would have the talent record the songs that the people wrote down the hall. Like, it's kind of crazy to think about it that way. And now, like, that's all you.
It is.
Like, you are the building with all those people working.
Yeah.
Try not to go crazy.
I can handle a little bit of that, but living in Nashville, I've witnessed so much of that music row sort of 9-to-5 writing, and props to them, because I just can't do it. It's just, like, not my nature. Like, I feel like my writing process feels very, like, spiritual to me in this weird way. And it just to like go in an office and I don't know, like it's fun for me every, you know, week or two just to like do a prompt or something.
Yeah.
But to have a schedule like that Monday through Friday, like, props to them, because, like, I can't.
There's the academic challenge of that, of taking something and seeing if you can, like, solve a puzzle. But it's not the same. It's not the same as, like, your thing that has the same meaning that art does to you.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, I think that might be what we're chasing here, is, like, we're trying to recreate the way that art feels to us.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to put our version of that into the world, I guess.
We're trying to feel something.
We're trying to just feel something. I know, that's what I do this, so I can feel something.
I can feel.
My cold, dead heart can feel something. When you were working on this record, was some of that in Portugal? Did you bail and like set up camp there? Was that like productive? What was that like? Oh, to be young. Just go to Portugal.
Well, it's kind of crazy. So I was like co-writing this British pop star's record, his whole record. And we spent like, he flew me out to LA, to London, to write all these songs with him. And hopefully a lot of them will end up being cut. But so he flew me out to London to write for his record. And then I'm like, can you extend my ticket? Kind of like what I did with the Jimmy World days. Hey, could you like fly me out later so I could stay? Yeah. And then I flew to Lisbon, and I kept extending my own ticket to stay because I was so inspired. Have you ever been to, we've actually been to Lisbon together. The first time I went to Lisbon was with you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, that's when I fell in love with it. I was like blown away.
It's pretty awesome.
It's like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's probably one of my favorite countries. But yeah, I went to Fado cafes every night and just completely fell in love with Fado music. The emotional vocals are so amazing. And yeah, it was just really classic, like inspired artist place. It's kind of, you know, becoming like the new Berlin.
Wow. And
yeah, it's great. I love it. So I wrote probably about 3 songs that made it onto Old Flowers in Lisbon.
Was That's How You Get Hurt? Wait, what's the song? That's How You Get Hurt?
Yeah, I wrote that there.
Because I was thinking, like, that one especially feels like the dynamics of the vocals on that feel like almost like a violin. Like the expression.
Oh, man.
The expression of that, you know? Like,
yeah.
How you're using, it might not be something you've ever, like, stopped to analyze that you're doing, but, like, the, you know, the kind of like really like using expression as a way to develop the melody, you know, over time and to change it up. And violin like is the way I can describe it.
That's really interesting. I, you know, a few years back, I worked at a music store for a minute, and I ended up with this fiddle because of this music store, and I played around with it for a while, and a violin feels, of all the instruments, the most like a human voice to me.
I've heard that said, that that's kind of like the most, the expressiveness of it is what you can do with it is closest to what like a
singing is
a really expressive good singer can do.
Yeah, just the way you can slide into things, and I don't know, it feels like singing a little bit.
Where you extend like the emphasis toward the end of a line and then start the next one kind of quiet, or going from like full strength to like speaking voice, indoor voice kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And like all the dynamics in between.
And the vibrato too.
Right.
You can, right. Yeah.
If you're good, If you're you, yeah. you can turn it on or off. I never learned how to do that. I never sat down and figured out, like, how to...
I kind of learned it as a joke, like, in school. Like, I remember this moment where people were, like, making fun of opera singers and choir or something.
Oh!
And then I just, like...
You started mimicking it to the point where you understood the mechanics of it?
And then it just, like, became a part of my vocal. Like, and now I can't hardly turn it off.
Right. It's a tool that you can use or not use.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, like, you probably just tap into it and don't realize you're doing it sometimes. Have you ever had an engineer or producer bring something like that up to you?
About vibrato?
Or been surprised because there was something that was noticed that you weren't even thinking of. Yeah, like vibrato.
Well, this new record was an intentional... We thought about the vocals more than I ever have in any other record in terms of... We made all the keys a lot lower. I think my producer and I both agreed we wanted to be very vocally subtle in terms of like we wanted it there. I didn't want to do any of my like Linda Ronstadt stuff on this record. You know, I wanted it to be a quiet conversation, somber, painful, you know, all that stuff. But and reflect that in the voice, you know.
I mean, it totally makes sense. That's what makes a song, like, if I told, like, so engaging, because you're listening to it, like, you got to get closer. You got to get closer to it, because it's here. You know, it's like...
Yeah. Yeah.
That's me. I don't know what... This is the phone, I'm trying to get closer to the music to hear what's going on. And that gives you room so that when you want that dynamic, that higher, more... intense dynamic, it gives you more room, so like you could do less to have more of an effect, or you could or you could just open it wide open and blow someone away. But you don't have to, because if you're starting here, the listener has to reset their expectations and reset their framing of it for here. So
yeah,
you just have to go here, and it's like, you know, it's a big impact.
My producer said to me, quite frankly, like, we know you can sing, but you got to sing with, like, the pain in you. Like, it's almost more effective if, like, singers, rather than trying to sing perfectly, sing with that whatever, you know, story is behind the song, you know, in them deeply. Even if it's off key or, you know... And so that was a huge marker for how I sang this record.
So. What'd you do to prepare for that on vocal day or vocal time?
I'm a terrible vocalist. When I start touring again, I need to like really think about vocal care. It's just something that I've never done. I've never prepared. I've never like warmed up before I go on stage. I don't like drink any like crazy tonics, you know. I really should. I'm not definitely not trying to boast that I don't. I just really don't, but I know I should, you know. It's important. So just feeling sad, that's how I prepared. I tried to like really feel like how I felt when I wrote the songs.
That's kind of more of what I meant, is like, I guess there's okay. like the physical preparation. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's interesting too. That's a good story.
Yeah.
Good story, Courtney.
Thanks, Jim.
What I was getting at is like, you know, your record is a really personal feeling. It does feel painful. It feels like you definitely got that. It kind of feels like you owe it to the song to try to get back there somewhat. If it is a tune like that, or even if it's like a more aggressive kind of up song, like you do have to kind of go inside.
Yes, you do. Yes.
To just not feel like a phony.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like people can tell with records you know, on in all ways, like if you're putting them on or if you really did feel in that moment. I mean, we did so many different takes, and it's just so funny how real that is, because like when you do a take in a studio that is magic, everyone in the room knows. You know what I mean? It's like nobody has to say anything. You listen to the take, but then afterwards, the whole room knows. And so I if that can happen in a studio context, the listeners that are out there listening to the record are going to know that too, you know?
I mean, if you're not getting that, then you're not there yet, I think.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe hit it again later on and see what it feels like then.
There's always that one song on a record that just kicks your ass. Like, you can't get the take of it, and it just, it takes so much longer than the other songs I've noticed. There's always one outlier.
It's always a dumber thing, too. It's not, like, the most technically challenging thing. It's like, I should be able to do that. Like, why is this hard all of a sudden?
Yeah, exactly.
You're kidding me.
It's maddening.
It's like, no, you're late. Like, every time, that's late. Like, what do you mean it's late? Like, I thought, I'm killing in here. Nope.
I know.
Nope.
Still late.
Sorry, man. I mean, you're doing, I mean, like, that was perfect. We just need one more.
Yeah.
Have you been able to pick up on producer tricks?
Producer tricks?
Can you tell when you're being manipulated into encouragement?
Oh, yes. Well, my producer for this record was, he's like all about the tricks. He's like he has like a perfect amount of toughness, but also like empathy, to where he can sort of laugh your way into a take if you need to, you know?
The sort of, hey, look at the bunny, smile, okay. Like a grown up.
That's a great analogy.
An adult version of that. Yeah. But it's not far off from what really is happening.
He did a lot of, if this isn't working right now, we're not going to do this today.
That's awesome.
Which is, I think, how it should be, because generally, if you're having a tough time with a take of something, it's not the day.
Yeah, especially if it's an important thing like a vocal.
I think with studio times, I think this was the first record where I didn't have to worry so much about that. And it was, you know, usually we're crunch time. I made two records before this in under a week in the studio. And this record, I was able to just relax and just not think about that, which I'm super grateful for. It makes it so much easier. And I think people like recording in home studios and stuff probably feel a lot, you know, better for that reason.
There's a positive and a negative to that environment of the expensive studio, you know, and it's the same thing. It's like, oh my God, how much money are we spending today?
Yeah.
Like, it could be encouraging, like, to get you to focus, or it could be something that you kind of spiral yourself into a insane person mode.
Did you guys record the last one at home or in a studio?
We did the drums at a studio at East West 2. And then we did everything else here.
Oh, nice.
Actually, there's three songs we did from scratch here. So it's,
are you still in the same space?
Yeah.
Amazing. For anybody listening, I recorded one of my records in that space.
Yeah, that's right.
I always forget that happened.
Yeah. Are you using any of the same people? Like, has there been like longtime like collaborator, partner people in the band?
There was, up until this record. There was some, there was like one or two members that stayed on until May or Kindness Remain. But this record was completely, everything was new. All new players. And I mean, there's not even that many players on the record. It's just me and two other musicians. So, but yeah, I had the same longtime band for, you know, six, seven years.
Do you feel like you're kind of growing in that sense of like, okay, like, you know, more what you want in an additional player, or is that something that you in, like in the producer kind of came upon for the kind of record you wanted to make?
For this record, it was definitely what we came upon. For this record, it felt like it needed, you know, just kind of minimal players. As far as like my touring band changing over time, like some people didn't want to tour anymore. You know, touring's really hard. I feel like it's not for everybody. and so, yeah, some people kind of moved on to other careers. And then I moved to Nashville. And so it's kind of harder to have a band that's in a million different cities and states. And
right.
Yeah.
Because you'd have to all meet up and rehearse.
Yeah.
I know it's not punk.
Which we did. Yeah.
It's not punk, but rehearsing kind of helps a little bit.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to rehearse.
It definitely does something for your first show.
What was that?
It definitely does something for your first show is being rehearsed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. The first show of a tour is always my least favorite, even if you're super rehearsed.
No, because nothing gets you ready to play like playing.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter how many times you run through something.
It doesn't matter. It's just your best guess. Like you can feel like you know what you're doing somewhat, but you don't. You really don't. It takes like I hate kicking off tours in like important
markets.
Yeah. Like, yeah? You're gonna play here to start? Like, I mean, it's cool. It sounds cool, but it's not.
No, I actually won't ever forget this. I don't know if you remember this, but I'm so glad you guys had a friends and family show, which also started.
I was just thinking
so
that.
My first show when I was backup singing for you guys, besides the friends and family show in Phoenix, was Letterman. Was David Letterman.
That's right.
And it was I was 19 years old and I was freaking out because I'd literally, you know, just come off like a Greyhound bus tour.
Yeah, that's right.
And then I ended up on Letterman and I was terrified.
Yeah, you were like playing wherever you could solo, riding a Greyhound bus. And then you go off of that. And then the first thing that we're doing is Letterman.
Yeah, like, speaking what? Of like first scary shows. Yeah, Jim.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty wild. I thought you handled it really well. I mean, yeah, I could tell you're a little bit nervous, but I mean, everyone's a little bit nervous.
No, it's just a comical thing in the context of our conversation.
I know you did. When you were younger, you did kind of more actually punk stuff. But I think from an outside perspective, a lot of what you were doing, even like musically, it was, I would put it in the more folk kind of world, but it was straight up punk rock, man. You know, like there's people playing punk music that weren't not as nearly as punk as you were.
Oh man.
For sure.
Thank you, Tim. I think I got major thrills from that kind of stuff. I mean, I still do in different ways, but especially starting off, it was like I loved the punk lifestyle.
Yeah.
I was okay with sleeping on bridges. I was okay with sleeping under bridges. If that meant that I could tour and play music,
Yeah, because I mean, that was the first thing you did when we stopped touring too, is like you did that in Europe.
That's right. I did the extend the ticket thing.
Yeah. I was like, we're going to the airport now. Okay, well, I'm going to get out here. Bye, guys.
Yeah.
Is she just going to walk? Where is she going?
I did walk. Yeah, with my backpack. And my my CDRs. It's
I know. That's like
my burn CDRs.
That is so punk. Like burnt a whole bunch of CDRs of your record that you were gonna sell walking around Europe playing wherever.
Yeah,
staying wherever.
Exactly.
That's awesome. I mean, but I think people don't realize that's what you have to do.
Yeah, I mean, you guys did that for years.
Yeah.
Floors and
it's like, yeah, you might have your goal in your head of where you want to be, but rarely does anyone actually get to that place because they're doing the things they think they should to get there. It's like the people who end up there, like, yeah, okay, that'd be cool, but we're gonna do this. Like, we're just gonna do this. Like, no one's helping me do this. I'm not waiting around for anyone to help me do this. It doesn't look like that, but it's we're doing it, you know? Like,
yeah.
We were so happy just to be on tour and to be playing music. Didn't matter if it was like, you know, the bar staff and the other band.
Yeah. Listening.
Yeah, it didn't matter because we were on tour, man.
I think a friend once said to me that I think it's like very true, and I feel like this is for anybody starting out. If anybody's asking you for advice for starting out, I feel like it holds so true, and that's that if you're stoked and surprised when you get your first $20 as a musician, then you're most likely gonna be in it for life. Like, if you're literally surprised, like, that you're getting money for doing it and you're just doing it anyways, it's most likely because you're a lifer, you know?
Yeah.
And
that's so true.
I mean, I won't ever forget those like first few years of touring. You know, we couldn't believe that we got money for music. We thought we were like robbing the venues. Yeah. We were like, what? We get $100? That's unfathomable. I couldn't even believe it.
We played Bottom of the Hill in 98, and the headlining band they were called Sleeper. They're a UK band. And you know, there's always been like this, like even back then, there was always this scene of people that just like followed everything from England. Like,
oh yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah.
Like they're gonna go see it. Like, you know. And so, I mean, for some reason we were on the show. Like, I don't even know why, but they put us as the anchor band. The anchor band. You know, like after the headliner.
Oh no, I know that. Yeah,
because they didn't want to go on at like 11. So
yeah,
and whatever, you know, they don't have to. They're, you know, they're calling the shots. So we played, and you know, it was to a steady beat of people leaving. Kind of like some people stuck around for a little bit to drink, and then you know, people left. And I remember we were loaded up in the van. And Zach comes running out of the club saying, go, 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 go. Because Ramona had given us $500. And we thought that they messed up.
No way.
We thought they messed up because like they thought that there was some mix up in who got paid as the headliner. Because like no way was $500 like for us.
Yeah.
So yeah. We just drove so fast out of there before we thought they figured it out and like want their money back.
Oh my God. That's amazing. I mean, that's the thing. It's like when you, I love that story.
What
venue was that at?
Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco.
Was that still around in like the 2000s?
It might still be around now.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's amazing.
At the time, that $500 paid for like the next 2 weeks of touring, because that's not what we were making.
No. Usually you come back like with $20 in your pocket when you do those West Coast tours, especially how much gas you use just to get up the coast.
San Francisco to Portland.
Oh my gosh.
Straight up 10 hours.
We used to do like weird little towns in between, like Ashland, Weed.
Yeah. But have you done any like international press?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of Latin American press and yeah, Australian press. Yeah, I've had like a few sanction days.
Do you have like your idea of what you want to say about the record that you can pivot to no matter what crap someone might be throwing at you? What are the questions that people ask you repeatedly that just suck?
Okay, with this particular record, it's been really I'm getting a little bit like I think what I'm starting to like feel weary of is because it's a breakup record, some of the talks have like veered into that area, and it's always a little awkward,
right?
Because I do you know, obviously want to keep my like things, some things personal and that sort of thing, so it's you know,
right.
that's been tough. And it's also funny because some journalists are like, they are aware of that too. They're like, well, I don't, without, how do we talk about this, you know? I think like the first, it's, you probably know this, like the first like few days of press are fine, and then after a while it's like you just hear the same questions over and over again.
I think I get better. I think it kind of helps me understand the record in a way when I'm forced to explain it and talk about it.
Me too, but sometimes I get into like robot mode where I'm just like, this is what I say.
Hello, you have asked the question where I say this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's funny you ask that, because I got a 5-minute story for you there. You just took yourself down this road now.
The first ones can always be kind of funny. What, when I first got press, like when I first... you know, got a label and actually had press and that sort of thing. I learned really quickly. It's like sort of, it is something you have to learn a little bit, like how to do press.
Yeah.
You know, I said some really weird stuff at the very beginning.
Yeah, because then like you get, then every interview you do after that is answer questions about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you got to be really careful with those first couple of interviews, like what you say, because people are going to be like, my biggest turnoff is like when any interviewer says, now you've said before that, and then they're, they just want any question that starts off with like, now you've said before that, then
yeah.
It's like, oh.
That's what it's becoming now, because I started press like a month ago.
Right. So all those people have read the first couple of things that you've done when they've searched what they're going to talk to you about.
And then you just ask it again, basically.
I don't get really offended about that anymore. I just think it's funny. Like when they want, want your quote, they want a personal quote of you basically reading the bio to them. So they can print that instead of just writing what you wrote out in the bio. I put out like a manifesto now of our records.
That, you do?
Yeah.
So you don't do press for him?
No, I do press, but I just lay out everything I want to say first. So that like...
Whoa, does it help?
Yeah. Because like people are going to just read that and then they're going to base all their questions off of that. So I give people where we're going to go with this before they even show up.
I kind of did that a little bit too with this record, but it was mainly like it's the bio for this record.
Right.
And people, because I like spent a lot of creative time with it, it wasn't really like a track by track or anything like that. It was just like a bio. People ask me more about the bio sometimes in the record. Journalists, I mean.
Yeah.
Which is funny.
It is
so
fine.
Yeah, it was my own, I guess, manifesto. Maybe it works.
Well, I think the record, what I've heard so far is really good.
Thank you.
And you definitely should
send it to you.
You definitely should be proud.
Thank you so much.
That's great.
Thanks, Jim.
And thank you so much for hanging out with me again.
Yeah,
thank you
for having
me. It's good to talk to you.
I'm glad that we were able to do it again.
Yeah.
So.
Awesome. Yeah. New record comes out next Friday.
Yeah. Oh God.
I don't think this will come out by that time, but.
Oh crap! I probably should have. I did, yeah, you could tell I've been saying doing press a lot because add that in a couple times.
No, man, you're a total pro all around. That's awesome.
Thanks, Jim.
It's funny that she was nervous about playing on TV because right before that, I remember she had just done her own tour around the country by herself on a Greyhound bus. You know, the midnight shank and grab seems a lot more sketchy than playing on TV, but you know, I was always really impressed with Courtney. You know, she wasn't waiting around for anybody to help her out. She was just doing it. Just do it. Once again, Courtney's album Old Flowers is out now and you should check it out. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay focused. I'll see you next time.